Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And as you know, Jem quite often gets a bit wound up with me, makes a few comments at the end of the episode when we've done a what if, and all I've talked about during that what if is food, even when it was entirely unrelated to the subject. So Jem, in order to keep my mind off the fact that I'm currently on quite an intense diet, getting down into shape, ready for the last airship, and I've not had anything to eat yet today, what topic are we discussing today?
We are discussing food. Food history.
Jem, you do these things just to annoy me, don't you, sometimes?
Yes, I do.
So, the history of food, right. Talk to me about this.
Food history, not the history of food, because the thing that's just worth pausing on for the moment is the one thing we have in common with everybody on planet Earth, with everybody who's ever lived, is we've all needed to eat. But what this struck me years ago, I was standing in the kitchen and I was cooking basically a stir fry with prawns. And I'm standing there thinking, is any of this stuff English? You know, when I grew up, and so many kids in Britain think that spaghetti bolognese, because it's a really easy meal to cook up and all the family's going to enjoy it, you get people thinking that's a standard English meal. Well, it's clearly Italian when you think about it. So the amount of food we eat that isn't from our country, crisps, another great example. Those will be potato chips to our American listeners. You just think, well, those are standard foodstuffs and probably our ancestors have been eating them for centuries. Well, they come from South America. So there's no way William the Conqueror was eating chips, crisps, things like that. I just find it interesting how much history, how much cultural exchange is just sitting in your fridge at any one point.
And are we going to go so far as to cause contention and everything else and point out the fact that, say, for example, haggis is not actually a Scottish dish, or are we going to leave that sort of controversy alone?
Well, I am not an expert on the origins of haggis, but I mean, just, you know, it's just an opportunity for us to perhaps tell some interesting stories or to raise some awareness on some of the things out there. And maybe there are a few misconceptions. Do you know what? I'm going to start with a misconception, okay? The croissant. There is nothing more French than a croissant. There is nothing more delicious for a breakfast than a good buttery croissant. But a croissant is linked to a very key moment in history that has got nothing to do with France. You see, there was a siege of Vienna. Vienna was attacked twice by the Ottomans, once in the 1500s under the Sultan of Suleiman the Magnificent, perhaps the most powerful Ottoman Sultan there ever was. But there was a second siege in 1683, and this siege actually was an even bigger deal for Vienna. And I know we've mentioned it in passing in the past, but here's the kicker. At the end of the siege, which the Habsburgs ultimately won, the Ottomans had to leave an unseemly haste after they were sneak attacked, but a very effective surprise attack against their lines, and they sort of fled and left all their booty for the locals to plunder, which is good stuff, obviously, for the locals. But a local baker, in commemoration, used the sign of the Ottoman Empire, the crescent, and made a pastry out of it. And that's where we get the croissant from. So nobody really thinks about the Siege of Vienna of 1683 when they're tucking into that buttery goodness. And had the Ottomans not attacked and that baker not been around, we would be oblivious to what potential joys we could have at breakfast time. But the croissant is absolutely a part of history.
I think as well as when we're talking about, and you're quite right, I had never thought when I was sitting down to my croissant in the morning, I never thought, oh gosh, I must remember the Siege of Vienna. Perhaps every mouthful I should, you know, eat in tribute to the Siege of Vienna. But I think one of the
now going to make a rule. We're going to do a Condensed History Gems rule now. Everybody who's listening to this, the next time you are munching through a croissant, every mouthful you must mutter to yourself, 1683. Then at least you know the year the croissant was invented. 1683, guys. That's what we got to do.
And there is all sorts of problems with these. Now, one of my problems I have when we start moving into this is, when we're discussing something like the potato,
yes,
you know, that's quite clear. Now, I think you actually had a story, I seem to remember it, I think you brought it up in your Fast Five, actually, about you being in a school or something, and...
Oh, yes. I was going to mention that again, so if I may, I'll very, very quickly go through this.
Yeah, you do your story for
us. So my boys know I like history, and therefore they like showing me off at certain times, and I was asked to come into the... This was infant school, so I guess we're talking about six-year-olds, seven-year-olds, so roughly that kind of age. And it was Anglo-Saxon Day, so I brought with me a few fun little stories that they might like about, you know, the Angles and the Vikings and things like that. But anyway, it turned out, really, it was just normal school, just they were all dressed up vaguely medieval, and they were making Anglo-Saxon soup, and they were, and the teacher held up ingredients and went, you know, would they have had carrots? And all the kids went, yeah. And the teacher went, yes, they did. And would they have had celery? Yeah, fine. Would they have had pepper? And all the kids went, yeah. And I sat there and went, no, they wouldn't, because we lost the taste for pepper after the Roman era, and it was reintroduced by the Crusades. But you know what? That's quite obscure. I'll let that one pass. But then she picked up a potato and said, would they have had potatoes? And everyone went, yeah. And she went, yes. No, potatoes, as I've already said, come from South America. What are you doing? Do you know anything about history? I mean, at that point, I lost complete respect for that teacher. Now, what the teacher was doing was teaching the kids how to make a basic vegetable soup. But don't lie to children, okay? That's only going to confuse them later on, you know, when they sort of discover certain elements which prove that that was garbage. So maybe I'm getting unnecessarily wound up about Anglo-Saxon soup, but that's me, okay? Anyway, yes, so thank you for allowing me to say that one. Over to you.
I've never heard someone get so ardently irritated about a potato. It's brilliant. I do like that story. But the fact of the matter is, when we're talking about a potato, it's quite simple. We know the potato we found. We know the origins of the potato. Now, when we're talking about things like the croissant, and
this nice pronunciation there as well.
Thank you very much. I'm going to get even more French in a minute. Now, when we're talking about things like that, and when we're talking about, and this goes back again to your little Fast Five you did a few weeks ago about sayings, because I almost followed it with another little bit about sayings. And my trouble is, so many origins of sayings, you very quickly get into, yes, but is it true? And this, the couple that immediately spring to mind is one, the legend of the origins of the sandwich, which is where I believe the Earl of Sandwich is playing cards and he wanted to be able to hold his food, so he had it stuck between two bits of bread and they called it a sandwich. I think...
Well, actually, what I heard was, everything you just said, yes, because you don't want to get your hands dirty whilst playing cards, but people would shout out the same as sandwich. In other words, I want the same thing he's got, which then got shortened to just, I want a sandwich. But obviously the idea of sticking stuff in bread was not invented in England in the, whatever, 1700s.
And the other one, one of my favourite ones, where I know at least two different potential origin stories for this particular one, is the baguette. I don't know why we've ended up both going with French food.
Yes. Again, that is as French as it gets, quite frankly. Yeah.
Now, again, but actually both the origin stories I know do actually have this being a French origin. Now, the first one I heard, which is my second favourite, but I'll tell it first, because actually it's the one that sounds most believable to me, if I'm honest, was that there was a law in the 20s which stopped the bakers in Paris working before 4 o'clock in the morning. And obviously, if you're baking a lot of bread, if you're a baker, you have to get up early to bake your loaf of bread. If you can't get up till later, you need bread that bakes quicker. You can't make a big, thick loaf like we tend to think of over here. Uh-huh. But if you make a long, thin loaf, then you've got the same amount of bread, but because it's long and thin, because of physics or something, it will cook quicker. I remember this stuff from the school. It will cook quicker. And so that is one theory for the origin of the baguette. That, to me, makes perfect sense. They could get up later, they could still cook their loaves, they'd have them ready for sale. However, by far my favourite theory for the origin of the baguette was during the Napoleonic War. Napoleon obviously wanted his troops to go into battle. He wanted them to be able to march easily. He wanted them to be able to pack as much food and kit and everything with them as possible. He didn't want any space wasted. And so the reason that baguettes are long and thin, of course, is so that the Napoleonic troops going into battle could store the baguettes in their trouser legs.
Yes, I smell a myth.
I'm sure you agree that that sounds perfectly plausible. Now, it is somebody's theory, and it is one that actually, on the internet, you get a lot of people coming up with different bits of evidence for. Personally, I'm slightly keener on the second one, but it does bring us to this idea that we have to be a little bit careful. It's the same as Shakespeare. Now, you know, Jem, that I'm a big fan of Shakespeare. I really do. And yet, every time somebody says to me, Shakespeare invented however many words or phrases it was he invented, I always bridle slightly, because what I then have to point out is we have a lot of stuff written by Shakespeare. We don't have an awful lot of stuff written by everybody else in that period. Chances are he's not the first person to have come up with all of these hundred things. He's the first person to write them down, because when you're looking at Shakespeare or something like that, it's a case of he's trying to do a play. If he writes a new play with 100 new words and the entire audience is standing there going,
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never heard those words before. I don't know what they mean. And it's always my problem. The same as, I say, the sayings and things like that. There are so many great sayings. I don't know if you've ever read it. There's a great book called Brewer's Dictionary of Fame, a phrase and fable, Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, well worth a listen, well worth a read. And it's just a history of sayings. And some of them you go, yes, I can see that exactly. Other ones you go, like the Napoleon baguette down the trouser legs, oh, I'm not so sure. But when you've got those competing ideas, we then very quickly get into, well, can we be sure? So I think we need to be a little bit careful when we're telling our legendary origins of food, that we just say, this is what we think at this point in time. And we're just a little bit careful about a lot of the things in history. It's how far can we get evidence for the origins of a particular type of bread?
Yeah, and look, there are huge gaps in history. We've got no idea the name of the person who invented bread. Now, somebody had to have made bread first, but we got no idea who that individual is. I think one of the other great ones, going back to the stir fry I was doing, is noodles. And I was sitting there going, well, okay, the two countries that are associated with pasta are China and Italy. I wonder which one came up with it first. So I sort of dug around and did the research, and it is China. It's China by centuries. There's even theory, although it is disputed, that it might even go back as far as the Neolithic era. But the point is, we do know that they have been eating noodles for sure for at least 3,000 years in China. But what's interesting is the first written evidence of dried pasta, because you know those sort of moist noodles that we associate with China, but dried pasta is something a bit different. But that seems to, the first written evidence is from Arabia, just sort of in the very late Roman era, sort of the 5th century. And it seems to have been used by Arab traders, because they were obviously moving stuff between the Arabian Peninsula and modern-day Iraq, sort of the sort of silk trail to a certain extent, but it's a bit far south. But anyway, the point is, you couldn't carry stuff that almost anything would spoil very quickly in that kind of heat. But dried pasta is actually a perfect way to fill yourself up, and you can carry it around, and it's not going to go off. So, that's worth pausing about and thinking about, wow, the journey it took for pasta to end up sitting on my plate at dinner time is quite a legendary thing. Even, and obviously nobody invented the chicken, but do you want to take a guess? They've managed to find out the origins, the actual natural habitat of the chicken. Where do you think chickens come from?
Ooh, and so we're talking modern chickens here, okay? We're not talking the evolutionary part.
We're not talking about sort of velociraptor. No, we're not getting into your other podcast here, Greg. No, but the modern day common chicken comes from which country?
I'm going to guess... turkey.
Well, it's the name of a bird. No, it's India, northern India. And if you think about it, quite frankly, a chicken is a terrible creature. It can't really defend itself. It can't fly out of the way of danger. It just seems to have almost been designed to have been eaten because it's delicious. So chickens have made the journey from India. Rabbits, we know, were introduced to Britain by the Romans. So there's all this food that's got nothing to do with our country that we think is very, very English or American or other such areas as well. And it's really, really interesting. Perhaps one of the most serious / saddest stories is chocolate. Now, again, as soon as you pause, most people know, that came from the Americas, and you're absolutely right. But if you look at the original recipe for chocolate, it was it had no sugar in it whatsoever, and it was actually flavoured with spices, so chili. So it was quite bitter and quite spicy, and it was a drink. Cacao, I believe, is what it was referred to as by the Aztecs. And interestingly, Cadbury World, just outside of Birmingham, which is still hugely popular to this day and a big manufacturer of chocolate, they used to have, well, they still have the history of chocolate, but they used to have a little dispenser where they were mixing up the original blend of chocolate. And I noticed it wasn't there anymore when I went back. And I asked somebody, why did you do that? Because that's really fascinating to see how much it's changed and how you can taste the chocolate. You can taste the cocoa there, but you cannot, but it's clearly very, very different. And they said, there were too many people just leaving them half drunk. You know, in their experience, about 50% of the people went, this is interesting, this is nice, I'll finish it off, this little sort of thimble full of water, of drink. And the other 50% were kind of spitting it on the floor, going, disgusting! And, you know, they were fed up of picking it up. So that's the origin of it. But what's interesting is they estimated with the collapse of the Aztec Empire and all the diseases coming in, all this kind of stuff, and it was a sort of sacred recipe, so it had to be forcibly removed from them and headed off to Spain. It's estimated that about 250,000 people died in the process of getting chocolate from the Americas to Europe. And when I told my mother that, she paused for a moment, nodded, and then went, worth it. And okay, my mother is not a war criminal or anything like that, but you know what? Chocolate has brought so much joy to the world that, probably it is worth it. And it was actually when chocolate started going into France, when the royal families were intermarrying, that it was the French who were going, I think we need to add some sugar to this. I think it'll be better then. And you had people like Mr. Cadbury starting to cut it with milk so it was far less expensive. Yes, the quality had gone down, but now it was a treat that almost anybody can enjoy. And from my recollection, if he wasn't a Quaker, it was something like that, like a sort of Seventh-day Adventist. But point is, Mr. Cadbury was one of the Christian groups that could not drink alcohol. It was banned, and therefore, well, how do I get my jollies? And the answer was, chocolate. That's quite a nice thing, and that's absolutely fine according to the Bible, because it's not in the Bible. So I've just thrown out stuff there about the wonderful world of chocolate and confectionery. Over to you, Greg.
Well, the initial thing that I thought there was that bitter chocolate drink that you were talking about there sounded so much nicer to me than chocolate. I know that might be.
Yeah, so you would have been one of the ones who enjoyed it, yeah.
I certainly would have been one of the people who enjoyed the sound of that one. That does sound pretty good. What I'm going to say, though, is one thing that you struck me both talking about difficulties of getting chocolate to and going through all that process, and also when you were talking about pasta and the fact that dried pasta is better when you've got to transport food, is something I think we miss and we lose a lot in food at the moment, and it's one of the problems. Now, I will probably bring this up more than once again. I'm going to warn you about this, Jem, in advance, but last weekend, I went to see Penn and Teller while they were over in London.
Ah, yes. I'm not about that yet.
Fabulous performance. We'll come on to the actual performance, I'm sure, on another episode. Fabulous performance. But after the after they finish up, you go outside and they actually wait outside and meet people. And I believe that they said that this was the first time that they were actually standing outside the theatre signing autographs longer than they'd actually spent performing the show, because they were at a 3,000-seat-plus-seat theatre. But Penn, for anyone who wants to go and look up someone that has managed a lot of weight loss, he lost, I think, last year about 100 pounds, just over 100 pounds in 3 months, using this radical diet. And I just want to add here his little, the phrase that he used. I am going to modify one of the words, but his phrase basically is, anyone that takes any diet advice from a juggler is an, well, let's say idiot, for want of his word, just to keep our clean rating. Because, you know, he writes a book all about his weight loss. But the basic theory of it is, and it comes from this guy called Ray Cronus, and there are a lot of nutritionists working on the same sort of idea. It's basically the idea that now all food is available to us all the time. And it's quite difficult to think back in history to a point where that wasn't the case. Food was seasonal. And the theory of their diet is the reason that obesity is a spiraling problem, especially in America, actually, but, you know, also in the UK, is because we never have a food winter, as it were. We keep, you know, we can get the same
sort of
food
time
all year round. Exactly. And you think even 50, 100 years ago, you know, I know the war adds a different element to that again, but you hear about rationing, you hear about the stories of the end of the war, when the first crate of bananas arrived, when the first fruits arrived from outside of the UK, and just this amazing thing, people have never seen them before. And it kind of, it's really difficult when we think back in history and we think of the, you know, those horrendous sounding meals that Henry VIII used to have, where it was one animal stuffed inside another animal stuffed inside another animal, and it was just meat, 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 meat. And you think about that, but then to a certain extent, you kind of forget, well, he didn't have the option of, you know, oh, I won't have the goose stuffed inside the cow stuffed inside the donkey today. Today I'll have the corn burger, please. That wasn't an option, you know. Food was, at that point in time, you had to eat. And obviously, he went too far by the end of the life. We can see that quite clearly from the way he looked by the end of his life. But in general, for most people in the past, food wasn't an optional thing. It wasn't a favourite thing. And coming back to you, what you said about the cocoa drinks, the chocolate drinks, the fact that half of that is left behind. Now, there are still places in the world today, obviously, where people are starving, but for the majority of us in the Western world, we are an incredible point of history. And I think probably in the last 50 years or so, the only point of history where people have food in abundance, where people are throwing away food, where people are turning down food purely because it's not their favourite dish, as opposed to because it's actually physically repulsive to them. People will just leave food because they're not that keen on it. And I think to try and put ourselves back in history into times when, yes, they couldn't refrigerate food, they couldn't set up a camp bastion in the desert and have cooks and cleaners and, you know, all this fresh food brought in from home, when sending an army into battle really was a case of, okay, well, we can send this many soldiers, but how many people do we have to send behind? How many pack horses just to feed these soldiers? I think it's just fascinating to try and just try and put yourself in the mind of the past at a time where food wasn't available in the same way as it is. And I'm going to stick my neck out here. In the same way it is to anybody who has half an hour to waste listening to our podcast.
Yes. Look, a few things to unpack. You mentioned a whole bunch of things there. Well, first of all, my mother has written a book, and it was published, but then it went out of print, so she ended up self-publishing it again on Amazon. So 40 Camel Girl, if you want to find that out. That's the story of an American woman who went to Turkey in the 1960s because she fell in love with a man. That turned out to be my dad, and she knew nothing about Turkey, and he had to go and do his military service. But if you can imagine a woman coming from an industrialized nation like America in the 1960s, going to a complete backwater like the Republic of Turkey in the 1960s, it was a complete culture shock. And one of the things, you know, people did not have refrigerators in their houses in those days. Turkey has changed a lot, for the record, over the last 40 years. But anyway, so she describes things like it's peach season. So, you know, everybody sort of went out and bought peaches in the market, and they, you know, they were sweet and they were juicy and they were ripe, and it was the perfect time to get them, and everybody enjoyed them for like a month, and then no peaches. So you take your shots while you can. You know, it's cherry time, it's watermelon time, whatever. And the fruits and the melons and the things like that, when they came to season, and you're quite right, you know, in Britain, there's a time when you would eat apples in theory, but nowadays, because the supermarkets will ship them in from perhaps somewhere like South America, any week is apple week or peach week or whatever. But linked to that, going back to the humble potato, I read an article about how important the potato has been in history. And one of the examples, and I know we've done a podcast about this, about the Seven Years' War, because Prussia was attacked by so many different people in so many different times, while ultimately Frederick the Great held his own, he was forced to move his troops around. And for the local populations, it's like, well, this week we've got the Prussian army sitting here, and next week it's the Russian army, and next week it's the Austrians, and so on and so forth. If they didn't have the potatoes sitting underneath the ground, basically immune to all this, these passing forces, there would have been hundreds of thousands more people starving to death. And linked to that, fish and chips, the most English of English meals. Okay, now obviously we know the potato wasn't particularly English, but it was invented in the 19th century. It did become a staple meal. And it kept Britain going during World War One. You know, just having enough nutrients and sort of food from battered fish and chips was enough to keep Britain going in World War One. You know, the sort of studies have shown that sort of supplemented the rations, and it basically kept Britain healthy. And yes, chips have been around before that, and fried fish have been around before that, but genuinely bringing those two together as a standard meal is genuinely an English invention, and coincidentally linked to a war. So that's how important the potato has been throughout history. And of course, the potato famine, if we're going to use a real extreme of dietary requirements, again, reading an article, drinking milk and eating potatoes gives you kind of just enough nutrients that you're not going to die of rickets or malnutrition. It's basically the cheapest way to keep yourself alive. And because the Irish peasants were so put down by their Protestant English overlords, I'm sorry, there's no way round this story. We're the bad guys here. But when the Irish famine, potato famine from potato blight, which was an illness that just, you know, does a bacterial infection of the potatoes, that, you know, the English didn't put it there. It's not the English fault. We can absolutely argue about, because the whole of Irish society was so dependent on the potato, when they started rotting, we should have done something about that. But that led to one of the largest human migrations in human history, when the Irish, because they were so poor and they had no other option, huge amounts of the Irish population either died or moved to America. So there wouldn't have been the massive Irish population in America had it not been for the fact that they were so dependent on potatoes in Ireland. So all that just coming from, as you said, this sort of need and demand for food and the reliance on certain food types. But I just want to lighten the mood after the Irish potato famine. The wonderful world of ice cream. You know, I've already mentioned chocolate as a treat. Ice cream, you know, you've again alluded to refrigeration. Clearly that isn't a modern thing, so or it has to be a modern thing. So when do you think ice cream was invented, Greg? And which country do you think might have invented ice cream?
Okay, so ice cream has got to be somewhere. Okay, if you're going to try and trick me here, we're not going anywhere too modern. It's got to be somewhere cold. I reckon Finland.
And what do you think? He's sort of maybe Viking era or something like that.
Oh, okay, and when? Yes, I forgot about the when part. I'm thinking Neolithic ice cream made with rocks.
Oh, I'm loving that. Okay, so we've got Stone Age people in sort of Scandinavia or Finland, sort of, you know.
Specifically
Finland. Specifically.
They invented Rocky Road ice cream.
A very specific chocolate, yeah, which has chocolate in it, which would be quite hard in Neolithic Finland, but anyway. Now, I was surprised by the answer to this. this one. The earliest recorded, I mean, okay, technically this would be a sorbet rather than an ice cream, but ancient Athens, sort of the Hellenic era, around about sort of 500, 400 BC. In the markets of Athens, people would run up to the mountains in the morning, get some snow, mix it with honey and fruits, and then sell it in the market during the day. And it's like, wow, so you're telling me ice cream is 2,500 years old? And again, that sweet spot, you know, we have a sweet tooth. The idea that, you know, human beings have always loved a little treat here and there. And actually, just my last point, I know we're sort of running out of time here, but I love the idea that some people have said, look, nobody actually has a sweet tooth. If you put a bowl of just pure sugar in front of people, nobody feels obliged to grab that and start shoving it down their throats. It's actually things like donuts and cake and things like that. That's when we think, oh, it's sweet. And they go, it's actually a mixture of fat, carbohydrate, and sugars. It's those three things together. And the ratio that makes a donut so pleasing is actually the same ratio of fat, carbohydrate, and sugar that's in breast milk. So the theory is we get a very baseline feeling for that is good for us. And then ever since then, anything that tricks us into those same ratios, we also think, oh, I like that. I'm going to have some of that. So unfortunately, we have to blame our mothers for why we love donuts so much. It is a theory rather than definitive proof, but I like that theory.
Okay, well, that is a fascinating ending to the podcast. We have run out of time for a Fast Five. It does just leave us time for our plugs, Jem. And you know what? This week, Jem, I am going to hand my plug over, not to you, but to your mother. So what was the name of that book again?
40 Camel Girl, which is the title is explained in the book. So that's by Sandy, S-A-N-D-Y, Duducu, D-U-D-U-C-U. So if you look for 40 Camel Girl, Sandy Duducu on Amazon, you'll definitely find it. You might even find the original version. She wrote under a pseudonym at that point and changed some of the names. That was, I think it was Grace Belair. But anyway, if you look for 40 Camel Girl under books in Amazon, you'll be able to find out a bit of more modern history. It's got some sweet stuff. It's also got some sort of very serious stuff and some sort of culture clashes as well. It's a really nice read, particularly if you're a young woman and you're thinking about what would it be like being in a very different civilization, very different culture. It's, you know, it's a really good book. Obviously, I'm slightly biased. It's my mother and, you know, it's about my extended family. But you know what? If you want to kind of see how another part of the world lives, one last, I guess, slightly serious thing. If you aren't Muslim, and of course you're hearing all this sort of stuff about fanaticism and terrorism, all this kind of stuff, reading about a Muslim family that is, you know, strict enough to go on sort of pilgrimage and things like that, but just seeing how they moan at each other and love food, and you just realize this is no different to my aunt and uncle or to my grandparents. It's just life. It's got nothing to do with religion. So it's actually a really nice way of sort of realizing, you know what, people are just people, for better or for worse. There you go. That's my thought for the day, Greg.
And it's been a roller coaster into the podcast, from famine to ice cream to anti-terrorism. That is the end of the podcast for this week. What I will say is, I mentioned it last week in June, we had a record month for our downloads again. This month is when people are starting to look for their podcast before they go away on their summer holidays, what they're going to be listening to on the planes and on the beach. So we are on a big push. If you can really help us out, you can go to iTunes, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and leave us a review.
Stick on
5 stars. Tell us what you like about the podcast. Anything you want to pop in there at all. Absolutely brilliant. But every review helps, even if you just leave 2 words saying good job. That helps us a great deal. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you, of course, to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Duducu.
And thank you very much to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And we'll be back again next week. Watch out for a Fast Five on Friday. But for now, goodbye and take care.